are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Tuesday, October 1st. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report on a hybrid Michael and Sam Tuesday. We're broadcasting steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA, on today's program. An interview Sam conducted with the great Marshall Steinbaum, economic analyst, on eliminating student debt in every way, shape, and form. Bernie Sanders raises a jaw-dropping $25.3 million in the third quarter, dwarfing his rivals the day after a new poll shows him leading in Nevada. I guess it's time to start demanding other candidates just drop out. Bill Barr personally asked foreign officials to aid in the inquiry into CIA-FBI activities in 2016. In other words, he is going to be a conduit for Donald Trump's milk brain in every way, shape, and form.
Might be how he's raised.
I believe so. Trump pressed Australian leaders to help Barr in his investigation. House subpoenas Giuliani, Trump's country attorney, for Ukraine's records. Trump may have lied to Mueller.
What?
Republican Congressman Chris Collins resigned a seat in the House ahead of a guilty plea for insider trading that we literally have video of. Just kind of hilarious. UAW strike pay starts after a weekend bargaining with GM produces positive signs, according to the union. And political prisoner Lula da Silva, 2 months after the corrupt Lava Jato team tried to move him into general prison population in Brazil, they now say, as mounting embarrassments continue in Brazil, as Congress demands answers on the DOJ role, they now have said that Lula should be released for good behavior into home detention. And Lula has refused. Said he's not leaving without full exoneration from his political imprisonment. Democrats say a diverse Congress may produce irreconcilable discord. I wonder which congressman that is. TPUSA cuts ties with a brand ambassador who was photographed with white nationalists. To which I ask, why? I thought you said their role was brand ambassador. What are you doing? Chicago Public Library to eliminate late fees, erase debt, and begin automatic renewals for up to 45 weeks.
Hell yeah.
That's great
Books,
news.
Check them out.
Absolutely. And WeWork, which somehow passed itself off as some type of viable business plan, is withdrawing their IPO. I guess the just utter skeleton model of this ludicrous business plan was getting a little bit too exposed there. Shouts to the Grubstakers podcast. Check it out, everybody.
Good episode.
They did the definitive breakdown of how WeWork works from the kibbutz to the boardroom. That and much more. Oh yeah. And it's like perfect, because it's like, of course, the one really interesting positive thing about the Israeli kibbutz would be the thing that the guy would discard.
Like, it was great to have community, but everybody was earning similar money. So I thought, what if we could do instant coffee and then tell people to bring out their laptops, and then somehow it would be a real estate scheme with Ashton Kutcher.
Oh my God. They stuck us in one of those co-working spaces when I was at Death and Taxes. It was awful.
Really? It was an inspiring community building exercise?
Well, we were crammed into a small windowless room with another website.
Well, yeah, I had some interviews in WeWork over the years. And my problem is a lot of the places, it's all windows. There's zero privacy. You just can see into everybody else's workspace and stuff.
That's
like
actually
that.
Fine. I haven't spent that much time in WeWork, but the ones that I went into were more along those lines of like, how does anybody like.
There's like
do
a bar with snacks.
So, and literally it's like coffee and pretzels.
I do
like,
want to
it's
say
so depressing. It's like
they've closed down their free snack section. So solidarity with all the workers that were stocking up on
their
snacks.
Free snacks
when
anymore.
The free snacks disappear, you know you're in trouble.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Take whatever you can, people.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you work at any sort of corporation,
yes. If you're at any sort of corporation, treat it like your own personal venture fund raid.
The amount of fresh fruit I ate while I was at Vice and just took home in my backpack.
I could see Matt.
And and let's face it, Coca-Cola.
Yeah, I was like, hey, Matt. I was at that Vice. You know, no, I was there. I'm trying to remember when. But yes, I did notice that. And I could see a Matt Leck making numerous Coke raids at the Vice headquarters.
I was freelance, too. I could have worked from home, but.
It's like, no, I'll come in. It's fine.
My giant backpack.
It's better to get some FaceTime in. So where did the beverage console go?
Ooh, cappuccinos.
You guys didn't move that, did you?
All kinds of Coke are available at the Vice office.
I stayed away from those people, those types. I'm a good boy.
That's right.
North Dakota.
Not
that's
me. Good.
That's right. Yeah, Coke hasn't been cool since like the 70s.
No, I know. I'm talking about like 15 years ago. I'm old.
We're not officially old yet. Folks, one of the biggest pieces of fear-mongering to block single-payer healthcare, to block an actual plan to cover every human being in this country, is this disingenuous talking point pioneered by Joe Biden and Tim Ryan that somehow it's unfair to labor unions because, and in some cases, some folks in labor unions do have very good healthcare, which can, of course, be taken away from them in a minute. They go on a strike, which is another great argument for single-payer healthcare. But also, even other folks who are employed or are in unions actually still deal with a lot of the same overpricing and gouging that most consumers of these parasite companies deal with. And this gentleman is one of those people, and he is going broke paying for his healthcare. He had an opportunity at the United Food and Commercial Workers Forum to ask one of the candidates about this. Now, unfortunately, the candidate he asked is maybe the candidate that there's something charming about her just basically like, you don't deserve shit. Check this out.
I'm fortunate enough to live here in this wonderful city. I've been a member for these 25 years as a meat cutter in one of our local grocery stores. I am a personal 5-year survivor of leukemia, and like many families, I am overwhelmed by the rising costs in the healthcare industry. My question to you candidates is, what is in your agenda to lower these health costs for our families and myself?
All right. Well, that's a great question from Dean. So, first of all, making sure that you can organize is key to this. That has got to be important because you're able to negotiate and work hard to get the best benefits for workers in your union, and other unions do the same thing. So I would make sure under my plan we protect those policies that you negotiated hard for. Because some of the other plans don't do that. There's some disagreement on this on the debate stage, and I am one that always has stood by allowing people to keep their plans, because there's 149 million Americans that have their own plans right now. They're not perfect plans. We want to do everything to bring the premiums down, but we got to remember that and not kick people off those insurance plans in 4 years, which is what one of the proposals does. So that's first thing.
Whoa, that is some top level. I was just about to say that I'm almost charmed by Amy Klobuchar, but that she really escalated the lie, the disingenuousness there. Yes, in 4 years under the Sanders plan, you will get kicked off of your almost certainly overpriced. Let me tell you something. And I will, of course, I want Medicare for all. I can't wait to get kicked off of my plan.
Oh,
are
please kick me off.
Please.
Oh, no. Anything but that.
Oh, no.
You're going to replace with a free one?
Yes.
No.
Wow.
That covers everything? No.
I mean, honestly, I'm looking at bills and I don't, you know, luckily enough, knock on wood, like I'm in good health. I don't use my insurance barely ever, right? It's an overpriced defective product that is there in case you get hit by a bus. And my God, the way these people have been with even some of the most basic stuff imaginable, I'm doubly petrified of getting hit by a bus because, I mean, that's exactly when they can mess with you most. You know, when you don't have the energy to argue on the phone with them. So even if you are one of a minuscule amount of Americans that has really good health insurance, it will be better when you are covered under a government plan. So this language is just, it's so toxically misleading and dishonest and, of course, jeopardizes tens of millions of people's lives. So I was going to say there's something that I find, I don't know what the right word is, but my annoyance level with Amy Klobuchar is actually low relative to other candidates. It's not like I look at, like when I look at Pete Buttigieg, it's like, oh my God, please, Jesus Christ, just get this guy off the TV. With Amy Klobuchar, I'm just like, yeah, sure, go for it.
She's the daughter of an alcoholic trying to be a perfectionist out there in the world. I get it.
Yeah, I didn't even know that. But like, what, you know, like I don't like her by any, I mean, she's awful, but I don't have like a visceral reaction to being annoyed by her. Well, but that is just such a toxic talking point.
Well, speaking of talking points from nominally progressive candidates here, Tulsi Gabbard recently said that she's on the, if you like your plan, you can keep it. I'm not into,
I look at it as a soldier.
And here's,
I look
the
at
thing
it as a soldier
about that little talking point. Anytime someone says, you know, I'm not, you know, if you like one more than the other, look, if the public option was being sold as, you're definitely going to like the public option better because it's going to be so much cheaper compared to whatever. But like, they always say like it might not be better. They give the option that it might not be better because they're not going to give you one that's going to knock out private insurance.
They're not, and the public option is not Medicare for all. I mean, people need to be incredibly clear about this. I understand that you can very narrowly litigate whether or not you're going to ban private insurance or not. And I said yesterday what my opinion on that is, which is like, yes, you know what? If you want to allow for private insurance to continue to exist, it needs to be either mutually owned or nonprofit, and it needs to be dwarfed by governmental healthcare to such a degree that it makes up a fraction of the market, and it is regulated more aggressively than a public utility. Sure, I guess. But anybody in an American, there is no candidate that is saying, I want to do it the French way. Right. They are using the language, Buttigieg specifically, Gabbard specifically, are using the language of Medicare for All. I guess maybe even Gabbard might not even be using Medicare for All anymore.
Yeah, it's true.
But
not.
Medicare for All who want it is fundamentally dishonest. It's not a public option. Medicare for All means you have a governmental program that covers everybody, period. And it's free at the point of purchase, and you have it. And that's it, and there's no nonsense. And Biden and Klobuchar and Ryan are open that they don't support it, and they lie about it, fearmonger about it. Buttigieg is fundamentally dishonest because he's basically talking about a public option but calling it Medicare for all who want it. Gabbard is either being dishonest or is just fully flip-flopped. I don't know which. And Warren, there's obviously a huge amount of ambiguity in her position, and what isn't ambiguous so far is that she's not talking about a plan that would cover mental health and dental, which is also essential to an actual robust universal plan. So, you know, these lies are only going to increase. And I would ask, you know, people who get touchy about a primary fight, even though it's literally a primary, we all got to make sure that, you know, particularly holding this talking point accountable. Because when an Amy Klobuchar is lying and fear-mongering about a good healthcare plan, what happens when a candidate like Sanders is the nominee? Obviously, I think it should be Sanders. I think that's a no-brainer. But even Warren, if Warren continues on the path of talking about Medicare, if Warren decides she lands somewhere there, or even if she doesn't, Trump will run against her on it. We need to make sure that these lies and these disingenuous talking points don't stick.
Yeah, we knew they were going to do this from the beginning.
That's
because
right.
Medicare for All is an incredibly popular phrase, and we knew they were going to muddy the waters and try to piggyback off of it while actually blocking it in its tracks. It also makes me really mad when people support something that leaves out dental or vision or mental health. Like, oh, did you want to insure your legs too? Like, oh, that'll be extra. Like, no, like every part of you, that includes your teeth, it includes your brain, it includes your eyes. Like, there shouldn't be any loopholes there. They're all a part of the human.
Yeah, dental should have been done in the 60s.
Yeah, it's outrageous. And I mean, the only valid criticisms I've really heard of the Canadian system are that it doesn't include those things. And that's where the argument is. All right. If you feel like you don't have time to read all the books on your list, you're not alone. Blinkist is the app that compiles the key takeaways from thousands of nonfiction books. Everything you need to know is condensed down into 5 minutes. Everything you need to know is condensed into 15 minutes that you can read or listen to with the app. Blinkist is really unique, and it works on your phone, tablet, or web browser. You'll find everything from health and self-help titles to history and business books included in Blinkist's library. Read a book like The 4-Hour Work Week or all of the great self-help books that Sam talks about. I am banking on Sam reading The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. When you can go through books like this that, frankly, maybe you don't need to read all of, but you need to get key takeaways to make your business or your life more effective, you, in fact, make your business and life more effective because you've saved a lot of time. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books. All the books you want for one low price. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist is a special offer for our listeners. Go to Blinkist.com/majority to try it for free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, Blinkist.com/majority to start a free 7-day trial and save 25%. Popular titles include, as I said, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey, How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie, Start With Why by Simon Sinek. That was the one that Sam was like, it's just Why by Simon Sinek. Hey, folks. Emotional Intelligence by Daniel Goleman. That's a classic in the literature. Fire and Fury, Inside Account of the Trump White House. That's a really good one to just...
It's hilarious.
It's absolutely hilarious, and there's a bunch of takeaways you want from that. And a whole bunch more, including also Getting Things Done by David Allen, which I am actually going to listen to on Blinkist. Check it out, folks. It will help you get the material you want in an efficient way. The problem that keeps so many businesses from knowing their numbers is their hodgepodge of business systems. They have one system for accounting, another for sales, another for inventory, and so on. It's just too big an inefficient mess that takes up too much time and too many resources, and that hurts the bottom line. Introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform that gives you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, finance, and accounting, orders, and HR instantly, right from your desktop or phone. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system, and right now NetSuite is offering valuable insights with the free guide, 7 Key Strategies to Grow Your Profits. I was just talking about this with Jamie. NetSuite.com/majority. That's NetSuite.com/majority to download your free guide, 7 Key Strategies to Grow Your Profits. NetSuite.com/majority. And finally, it's one of my great regrets in life that I only know one language. I didn't retain any Turkish from the time I was there. And frankly, a lot of language pedagogy ain't great. And I never took to it. Which is why I'm about to download the Babbel app. Babbel is the language learning app that will get you speaking a new language quickly and with confidence. Choose from 14 languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, German, and speak with confidence. Babbel's teaching method and speech recognition technology has proven to be effective across multiple studies. It's designed to get you speaking your new language within weeks. Babbel's lessons are lovingly created by over 100 language experts, aka real people, not by a translation machine. That is a huge difference right there. I do not buy all of these you can do it without actual humans myths. Lessons are engaging and convenient. They last only 10 to 15 minutes. Learn through interactive dialogue so you can perfect your pronunciation and accent. It actually sounds kind of fun. Just think of it as one giant impression off. Babbel is available as an app or online, and your progress will be synced across all devices. Be bold and learn a new language with Babbel. As I've said, I really want to learn Portuguese. If I was being super ambitious, which, and this is, I'll just put, I mean, I'm not going to learn all of these languages, but I would say Spanish, obviously. Arabic could be quite useful. Mandarin, definitely, though very hard. And I personally would very much like to speak Portuguese because of all the work I do around Brazil. Here are the easy steps to speaking a new language with confidence. Go to Babbel.com or download the app. Select the language of your choice and try it for free. That's Babbel. Babbel.com. Babbel. Speak a new language with confidence. We're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with Sam's interview with Marshall Steinbaum.
We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Marshall Steinbaum. He is an assistant professor at the University of Utah and a senior fellow at the Jane Family Institute. And Marshall, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
So I want to talk about a piece you wrote in Current Affairs. This is around the concept of student debt. You were at the time... this was, I think, shortly after Bernie Sanders, or maybe actually a couple of months, Elizabeth Warren put a debt cancellation proposal on the records, on the books, as it were, in April. Sanders came out with one in June, which was a little more extensive. And then there, you know, there became sort of a controversy around the concept of forgiving student debt. And I want to talk about that. That's what you're writing about specifically, but more broadly, just if you could broadly summarize the two different plans, how they're different, and why they're good. Well, at least I guess, I mean, not having debt is good for those people who not have debt, but give us a sense of the two different plans.
Sure. So I guess it's easier to start with the Sanders plan because that's a little bit more straightforward. That would cancel all outstanding student debt. It's a little bit more complicated if you get a little bit more into the details because the federal government is the creditor for 90% of outstanding student debt. So that's kind of easy. It's a little bit more subtle. What happens for the debt where the federal government is not the creditor, it essentially amounts to the federal government assuming payments on behalf of the people who are currently paying it. So the Sanders plan is, you know, currently something like $1.5 trillion of student debt outstanding. Through one mechanism or another, the federal government would make it so that you don't have to pay if you are currently paying on your student debt or if you're in income-based repayment or otherwise have your payments mitigated.
All right. Let me stop you there. They're just because I want people to be really aware of this. So we're talking about $1.5 trillion of debt. I mean, you're an economist. You're better at math, I would hope, than I am. But 90% of that, we're talking about like $1.2 some odd trillion dollars. It's all owed to the U.S. government.
Yeah. So when the federal student loan program began in the 60s and especially in the early 70s, the federal government wasn't the lender. What it was doing was essentially standing behind students who took on debt from private lenders and said, you know, these people are, you know, basically 18-year-olds or, you know, early in their careers. They don't have any assets. They may not have a job. They probably don't have a job since they're going to college. So very hard for them to get loans just directly from a bank. So we what we want is for people to take on student debt to go to higher education. The federal government needs to do something, that is to say, guarantee that debt so that these are better, more creditworthy borrowers from the bank's perspective. In 2008, 2009, a lot of the student lenders in that business came near to bankruptcy as part of the overall financial crisis, and they went to the government and said, you know, we're on the cusp. We might not be able to actually have a new class of students students enroll in the fall of 2008. This is a crisis, and you know, you're about to throw a lot of people who think they're about to start college out on the street, so to speak. So you need to give us something. And essentially from there, over the course of the next 2 years, there was, I think, two pieces of legislation. I wasn't directly working on this issue at the time, so I could be wrong on the details here, but essentially two pieces of legislation such that by 2010, the federal government was the direct lender to all new originations of student loans. And for that reason, the federal government now is the lender for a huge majority of outstanding student debt. It's worth saying that the first of those pieces of legislation essentially amounted to the kind of student loan side of the bailout of the 2008-2009 financial crisis, in that these lenders had a bunch of securities on their books that, or loans on their books, I should say, that nobody really knew if they would be repaid. And the deal was they would basically give those to the federal government, and in exchange they would get a bailout. And what happened was they gave the crap to the federal government and it got a bailout out of that. And, you know, so while it looked like, you know, if from a kind of naive perspective, a nationalization and, you know, takeover of a private industry, in reality, it was a pretty nice, sweet deal for the insiders in that industry.
So, oh, that's fascinating. I didn't realize that that was the case. So they had these loans, this huge book of loans. I mean, and we're talking probably about a bunch of different loaners, and, you know, they're servicing their own loans, presumably. Or maybe they're not. I don't know that market. What happened in that market as much, but the U.S. government bought these loans essentially from these private enterprises. Do you know how much they paid? Like, did they pay dollar for dollar on these?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I'm not exactly the man to answer that question. My former colleague Julie Margetta Morgan wrote a paper about exactly that in 2018. So I would look at that and see exactly what the terms of that kind of swap were. And just to kind of go back to what you're saying about them servicing their own loans, those are who the servicers are now. So there's not, you know, what was the private student loan, you know, finance business where you, you know, you're a bank, you borrow short term to lend long term. That's basically what the business is. But the point is you have a stake in the spread of interest rates. That's how you make your money. They went from that to a commission business, basically, which is the current servicers. So they weren't totally cut out. In fact, part of the sweet deal that the federal takeover brought about was that these companies now are the ones who are in the business of collecting
the fees.
People's money.
Right. They're getting fees at this point.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
Okay. And and then this makes sense to me, because at one point I do remember there being, and I don't know if it was Warren or Bernie at this point, frankly, who had this proposal several years ago about cutting down on the interest rate, because we're still charging the students who have this debt an interest rate that was established, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, by private industry. There's no reason for the U.S. government at this point to even be charging any interest on this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge debate within the higher education policy world about the status of you know, student loans as a financing mechanism, but more specifically, the interest that should be paid on them. The government has it in its power to reduce the interest rate. Of course, it's the lender. And so the question is, you know, how nice do we want to be to outstanding student debtors versus how grasping is the federal government as a creditor? And I would say there's an interesting kind of left-right divide. I mean, there's a left-right divide isn't anything, but the right-wing position, you might say, is that students with outstanding current debt should be paying through the nose as much as possible. The federal government should be subsisting as far as possible on the interest payments of outstanding student debtors. And so I would say, kind of before we got into the cancellation debate that's going on now, the kind of key ideological clash was on this matter of refinancing of student loans, because my understanding is, you know, the market interest rates, specifically the interest rates that the federal government has to pay on its own debt, have declined. And so the spread between what students have to pay and what to the government and what the government has to pay to its own lenders, that is, you know, who's ever buying treasury bonds,
right,
that's wide. And so the federal government is making a huge profit. So that dynamic creates kind of its own set of stakeholders, which is to say the federal government as, you know, a someone who wants to be paid as a creditor.
Right. I mean, I can afford more tax cuts if I was concerned about affording them on the backs of students who are paying off their debt, because that's basically subsidizing. I mean, I think that's an important dynamic for people to understand, particularly in the context of what you've written about, that as it stands now, our student debt is basically financing tax cuts, right? I mean, that's basically what it's coming down to, that this profit is being redistributed up to wealthy folks who are getting government services at a discount now because they're getting these tax cuts that have recently passed. There's a whole set of other ancillary issues around this, which I imagine, you know, these loan servicers, I imagine we could dig through that and find some problems there. And we also know that loans that were made in for profit universities, which were fraudulent, the Trump administration has now basically rolled back some protections for those people who've been defrauded in terms of the loans that they've taken out. But I think it's important for people to understand that this is all taxpayer money. And even without getting into the question as to whether or not the federal government can simply look on its books and just say, poof, you don't owe us anything. Let's get to these two proposals. You mentioned Bernie's wipes out the debt completely. How does he and Warren has another plan that's a little more complicated. We can get into that. But how does Bernie, you know, pay for his plan? It would be the question that I would ask if I was moderating a debate on a national broadcast channel.
So I believe the answer to that question that the Sanders campaign would give is that they plan to levy a financial transactions tax.
Okay, so there it is. So that then, there's also a very strong argument that we could just say, yeah, don't worry about it, right? I mean,
I would say it's a little more complicated than that. So I wrote a paper in, I think it came out in 2018, with the Levy Institute, that was kind of going through the mechanics of exactly sort of who's paying, if not current student debtors, so I would refer to the paper for the nuts and bolts of that. I would say the upshot is, it would in some ways blow a hole in the federal budget going forward to not have students repaying all those loans for all that time. But, you know, we've been blowing holes in the federal budget left and right with TCJA and all sorts of other, you know, programs and tax cuts that are just designed to shift the burden of paying for the government from the backs of profitable corporations and the people who own them to everyone else, including student debtors.
So Elizabeth Warren's plan is not quite as ambitious as Sanders, but significant. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, so there are two big differences between the Sanders plan and the Warren plan, and I wouldn't necessarily say that, I mean, the Sanders plan is, I guess you could say, more ambitious because it cancels more debt, but I think it's important to kind of keep in mind what the kind of two different distinctions are, because that tends to have an enormous effect on kind of what we can say the impact of the two plans would be. So for one thing, in contrast with the Sanders plan, the Warren plan would cancel $50,000 of outstanding student debt at max. So if you have more student debt than $50,000 outstanding, you would be left with whatever is the increment above $50,000. And secondly, it has a phase out for individuals with incomes above $100,000 a year. So for every dollar that you make above that $100,000, the amount of cancellation that you would get would decline by a third. So basically you have a kind of phase out that goes from an income of $100,000 to an income of $250,000, wherein you lose a dollar of cancellation for every $3 of income. And if you make $250,000 or more, therefore you would get no cancellation from the Warren plan. So there's two distinctions, one, the $50,000 cap, the other, the phase out for relatively high income borrowers.
So to some extent, it's you would say Warren's is means tested and capped.
Yes.
Okay. And what is the estimates? I mean, obviously, for Sanders' plan, the estimate for getting rid of all of the government debt is the net amount of government debt. I should say student debt And so it's $1.5 trillion. What does Warren's plan project would be the amount of debt that was paid off?
Yeah, so that's actually a good question to which we don't have a very clear answer. I believe that the number the Warren campaign was going with was $640 or $650 billion. And the reason why that's probably an underestimate is that there are a lot of people who have student debt that are not counted in the federal survey that that number is based off of. This is my, I mean, I know that that's true about that federal survey. I think that that's where that, that calculation comes from is counting up the total amount of cancellation of debt canceled as represented by that survey. And the problem is that survey, the Survey of Consumer Finances, undercounts the total amount of student debt outstanding. We know that for a fact. And in particular, what we also know is that the undercount is coming from relatively low-income younger individuals. So I can get into the details of why the survey undercounts that, but this is a pretty, I wouldn't say well-known, but the people who use the survey, you know, are kind of aware that it is, it's designed to capture certain things, and it's not really well-designed as a survey of the total amount of student debt that exists in the population.
Okay.
So the reason why we can say that the Bernie plan, we can say with more accuracy that the Sanders plan cancels $1.5 trillion is because that's what the government says is the total amount of student debt outstanding, and Sanders just said I'm canceling all of it. Warren's plan is I'm going to cancel some of it. I'm restricting the what I'm canceling in these particular ways, that is to say the cap and the phase out. And the problem is we don't know exactly how much debt is sitting in the households that are within the restrictions of the cap and the phase out.
Okay, so fair enough. So we're looking at anywhere from it sounds like Warren's plan is a minimum of half of the student debt in the country, and could then be closer to, you know, somewhere between half and three quarters. I mean, these are, you know, broad strokes, but that's what it sounds like.
Yeah, I agree with that. And in fact, I think in some ways, because of this deficiency, some of the attacks on the Warren plan from both the left and the right have been disingenuous. I mean, disingenuous means that they've been dishonest. I don't mean to say that it's based on malice or something like that, but I think the Warren plan is closer to the same Sanders plan than a lot of people have said it is, and that implicates attacks on it again, as I said, coming from both the left and the right. So some people say it's bad because it's close to the Sanders, or because it's not close to the Sanders plan. Some people say it's good because it's not close to the Sanders plan, and both of those are wrong because it is actually pretty close to the Sanders plan.
Okay, but it's based on a faulty premise on some level that the numbers are an accurate reflection of the overall debt, and so the algorithm that's applied to cutting away that debt is going to get you a number that is not quite accurate. And so, all right. Well, so with that said, the practical differences may be less. There may be more of like an ideological difference in terms of, the concept of universality versus means testing, and may have some political implications, not necessarily dollar for dollar implications. So the material implications may be less than the political, I guess, or ideological. But nevertheless, one of the critiques of both the plans that you write about in this piece in Current Affairs is the notion, and in some ways this reflects, you know, this came up during the Clinton Sanders debate over, you know, free college, the idea that you don't want wealthy people, you know, you don't want Donald Trump's kids going to a free public college. Which I think is a little bit short-sighted. That would be a great thing to actually have had happen. I think the country would be much better off, frankly. But with that said, the idea is that people are saying this is regressive by cutting the student debt for college goers, because I think the criticism goes like, hey, you're forcing people who don't go to college. And, maybe I went to vocational school and, I'm a plumber. I served as an apprentice for a couple of years and now I'm a full plumber. And, why should I have to pay my tax dollars, if that's the way we're going to finance this, to relieving student debt for college students. That seems to be the criticism, correct? What are the premises that are embedded in that criticism? In other words, the assumptions about who's who in all this?
Yeah, I think that's exactly that gets to the heart exactly of the politics of this, and I guess the ideology of this. There's a longstanding false assumption, in my opinion, that everything associated with higher education is elite. And so it's kind of stemming from that assumption that you get an attack on the idea of free college, that it is a regressive policy because it's basically a government handout to the upper middle class. The upper middle class that tends to be the people who go to college. And so why should, Joe Schmo, who didn't get the chance to go to college, pay taxes to the government in order to subsidize the college education of somebody from a well-off family. And then, so that's kind of one genre of argument. And then the flip side of that, when you get to student debt, is, what about the people who don't have student debt or who paid off their student debt? Why should they be saddled with the increased federal tax burden or federal debt to account for the cancellation of the student debt for everybody who did go to college? I would say it's important to start generally, because when we get into the specifics, it can tend to obscure the generality. It's just false that free college or student debt cancellation is a giveaway to elites, because it's false that public higher education is a giveaway to elites. This was, I think, a convenient talking point for the fire of austerity to be directed at public higher education in this country. But the reality is, when we established public higher education, that radically expanded access to a public good, in my opinion, that was previously constricted to 2 or 3% of the population, the very tip top who got to go to these fancy and very exclusive institutions. In the post-war era, we created a bunch of public higher education systems that were much more accessible to the broader public. It's not to say that higher education was totally egalitarian. It has always had an hierarchical and exclusionary quality to it. But we experimented with expanding public higher education, and it had its intended effect, which is to widen educational opportunities for the vast set of the population. More recently, we have constricted access to higher education, including on the ability to pay for it. We've transferred the cost of public higher education from state budgets and the form of state budgets, meaning taxpayers in the state, to the users of higher education, which tend to be students. So they're younger and less white than the taxpayers of states. And, the result has been the student debt crisis. So I just don't buy that higher education is a social construct, or I should say public higher education is a regressive it's regressive because it pays for people who are well off at the expense of people who are not. I thought that this is a talking point that most recently the Buttigieg campaign has been bandying about, and it's not just false, but risible and offensive, in my opinion. And I should say I'm especially worked up about this because I myself used to believe that. And so I have this sort of zeal of the converted as to the view of higher education as being an elite project, or public higher education as being an elite project. Okay, so to get to some of the criticisms that you mentioned against the Warren plan that I spoke to in the Current Affairs piece, there's this idea that it's unfair to people who've already paid off their debt because why shouldn't they have just waited around to get it canceled rather than to saved over the years to pay it down. And it's also unfair to the people who never went to college or never took on student debt. And my view is that overall critique is internally incoherent. The people who have paid off their student debt, and especially the people who never took on student debt for their higher educations to begin with, that those tend to be well off relative to the people who currently have student debt outstanding. And this gets to the larger, I would say, change in the role that higher education is playing in society and the labor market, which is increasingly it's a requirement to enter the labor market get at anything other than the bottom rung to have some experience of higher education. And because of increases in tuition, thanks to reductions in state funding, having some higher education increasingly means you definitely have student debt, unless you come from a well-off family, in which case they're able to pay for your college.
Okay, let me stop you here, because we're getting it. There's, you know, I want people to be able to parse this out, and you're moving into the credentialization dynamic. But when we talk about these two different sort of cohorts, right, the ones that have paid it off, you're saying, your argument is that they are necessarily the highest income cohort of everyone involved, and they need that debt the least, paid off the least. And that critique is not sort of like bundled with the other critique, which sounds like, I never went to college. And the presumption is that the cohort of adults who never went to college and never incurred that debt are necessarily coming from from lower income than those people who did assume the debt. Is that it?
Yes, I think that assumption is indeed going on in the background. When you say people who never went to college, you know, there's different types of people who don't have student debt. One is the people who never went to college. So those people will tend to be both older, that makes them richer, but also poorer, so obviously that makes them less rich relative to people who do have student debt or who did go to college. So when we talk about the people who didn't go to college, we're probably talking about people who are less well off than people with student debt if they're older. But my argument, okay, so that's one set of people.
Right.
The other set of people is the people who did go to college but either never took on student debt or did take on student debt and paid it off.
Right.
That set of people is unambiguously better off than the people who currently have student debt outstanding.
Right. So it's the former group that is at least consistent with the critique of it being theoretically or possibly regressive, right? I mean, okay.
Yeah. So this is where I think it's important to discuss credentialization, because, you know, that this idea that you've got, you know, people who had a career without encountering higher education, or certainly without encountering student debt, because maybe they did have higher education, but it was in the era before the current huge rate of tuition increases. You know, those people are older relative to the current students. And my argument about credentialization is that at least for recent cohorts, higher education or some involvement in higher education, and therefore some involvement with student debt, unless you're rich enough not to need student debt to pay for education, that is an increasingly universal experience, both because the routes into the labor market that didn't require a higher education have been closed off. So if you're referring earlier to, you know, skill trades where you could, you know, possibly have been trained on the job and then, you know, kind of wholly avoided the formal higher education system en route to a middle class life, you know, those are increasingly gone, as well as the routes to the labor market that do involve higher education. You know, it's increasingly unavoidable that they also involve student debt, given the huge increases in tuition that have occurred in recent decades. So to you know, sort of tie that knot, or so to speak, you know, so we're talking about, you know, the people who don't have college education relative to the people who currently have student debt and may or may not have completed, you know, some amount of higher education. I think that's where the ambiguity of economic status really comes into play. And while it is, as I'm saying, ambiguous, it's definitely over facile to say, oh, this is poor people paying for the education of rich people.
Right. And then certainly in the context of, let's say, Sanders, when he was talking about a financial tax, trading tax to pay for this. I mean, we know that stocks are held by a very limited number percentage of people in this country. Right. Like, you know, 25-30% maybe. And the idea of the tax burdening people who own, let's say, pension funds, which are not heavily traded, theoretically, it's pretty small, right? I mean, this is just sort of like, I guess the argument is like, well, we could impose that financial transaction tax and it could go towards other things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not really in a position to comment that much on the tax side, but I will say, you know, the financial transaction tax proposals that I'm aware of, you know, it's not even just on people who own stock, like, you know, who might have a pension, for example, or a 401k. It's really specifically about the people who trade stock at a very high frequency.
Right.
And, you know, that's a tiny subset of the even the financial sector, let alone the public. And, you know, so, I mean, as transaction taxes go, a financial one is a pretty progressive one. I believe the Warren campaign would tell you that their student debt cancellation proposal is financed out of their wealth tax, and there's no doubt that a wealth tax is progressive, given, you know, that's kind of in the name of it. If you have wealth, you pay the tax. And theirs is progressive even beyond that. I think they have a higher rate on people with a larger amount of wealth.
Just talk, I mean, so, you know, and so basically, you know, your piece in one part talks about the sort of the it debunks this argument just from a, I guess, maybe not necessarily from a data step, but from a reasoning perspective, and that this is not regressive. Are there data sets? I mean, is there a way to really sort of assess this before going in, or is it is it all you can do is model it and wait and see? I mean,
I would say, well, we don't. The public doesn't know that much about individual student debtors relative to even other sort of federal programs, because the data that tracks individual student debtors and their progress to repayment is pretty well totally inaccessible to the public. The few papers that are published and in public are written by researchers who had access, who worked either for the Treasury or the Education Department. I think both of them worked for the Treasury, in fact. And, you know, not only that, most recently, the Education Department has kind of publicly cast doubt on the veracity of those papers. That may be politically motivated, frankly, because the authors of those papers were using the research to essentially make arguments that the Trump administration doesn't like. But, you know, the upshot is we don't know that much about individual student debt because it's really near impossible for public researchers that aren't on the inside to get access to it. And of course, these federal departments have veto power basically over the publication of anything coming from the insiders. And so, you know, if there's a paper and there is some research in there that shows something really dire happening in among student debtors, they can pretty well quash it. We do know, I mean, based on the little information that does come out, we do know quite a bit. I mean, basically, whenever we learn something more about the student loan system, it's never good news. And so they do these releases where, for example, we've found out that delinquency rates among Black borrowers are way higher than had previously been known. There had been this thought that, oh, delinquency is kind of caused by people not completing their college degrees. If only people could complete their degrees, then they would realize the earnings increase that you get from a college education. And because they have that earnings increase, they'd be able to repay more easily. Well, we have data that shows that's just not true. I mean, delinquency is indeed higher among people who don't complete, but it's still very high, especially among Black borrowers, among people who do complete their undergraduate education. And, you know, it's just flatly on its face inconsistent with the whole argument for the expansion of the federal student loan program in the first place, which is that this is actually a labor market policy because everyone taking on student debt to pay for more higher education credentials will cause them to earn more in the labor market.
Right. That's one of the big fallacies that we've developed. And that's where you get into that credentialization, that the basically what happened is the more people got degrees, the more the bar was raised as to what qualified as a degree that was going to help you get more work, presumably. To what extent do we know, like, when we talk about these different sort of examples of debt, African-Americans within the, you know, in terms of the student debt, more likely to have student debt even after having completed these colleges? Do we know the breakdown of for-profit colleges in this? How big of a piece of it, of this question of the debt, is a function of the for-profit college system?
Yeah, actually, I'll take this opportunity to say that I think it's time to move the conversation past the for-profits, which is not to say they're not bad.
Right.
They're definitely highly predatory. We know for a fact that they don't increase earnings for people who obtain degrees from them or even don't obtain degrees, and they're enormously kind of evil creditors. That is, they're a cause of lots of the delinquency that's existing in the system. The reason why I say I want to move past them is, in some ways, their business model is already, or at least their business, I should say their business model, their businesses are already in decline. That's not, you know, as you alluded to earlier, that doesn't mean there's still not enormously a population of suffering people who were predated upon by them in their heyday, and we absolutely should cancel their debts. And it's shameful that the Trump administration is, you know, basically rolling back what little the federal government had been able to do for them. But I want, you know, I think it's important to kind of recognize that the credentialization problem and the segregation problem in higher education go beyond the for-profit. So one of the reasons why lots of people focus on the for-profits as the villains of the higher education system is, you know, they rightly see that the higher education as a whole is very segregated in the for profits serve a disproportionately non-white population and
right.
A population who traditionally lacked access to traditional higher education. So people who are later in life who aren't in a position to go spend 4 years living on a college campus, you know, because they have children, because they're working, whatever. You know, that's kind of the population that the for-profits rushed into the void to serve during the especially during the financial crisis when unemployment rates were high. And so they sort of had a very much a kind of boom and bust cycle. And we're in the bust for the for-profits. The problem is the nonprofits.
You should tell that to their stocks, incidentally.
Yeah. Okay. Well. I am telling that. Hopefully, they're listening to somebody who understands the industry and not their naive boosters. But whatever. The problem I would say is that the nonprofits have kind of figured out how to make that business model increasingly profitable. Or you've got what's now the sort of coding boot camps that, you know, they're not purporting to deliver the same degree as a for-profit that is essentially saying we are giving you a BA that's comparable to a BA from a traditional institution. You know, the coding boot camps aren't saying that. So my point in this is that the for-profit clientele and the for-profit business model has basically bifurcated to the nonprofits as well as to the you know, non-traditional degree granting for-profit companies. The what I've summarized as the coding boot camps, and you know, I mean adoption of the for-profit business model by the traditional nonprofit higher education, I think, poses a grave challenge to the regulation of higher education, because there's a lot of value associated with these prestigious names. And at least as regards federal policy, they have largely gotten what they wanted, even under the Obama administration. You know, the Obama administration instituted a bunch of regulations that, you know, came very near to putting the for-profit industry out of business, and that may happen again, notwithstanding relaxation under Trump. You know, there's basically very little pressure on the nonprofits to move away from a credentialization type business model, to move away from a business model that is especially predatory on students of color. I mean, this is why segregation matters even outside the for-profit context, because they are confined to institutions that are historically less well-resourced and therefore more dependent on predatory business models.
Okay, so to summarize in terms of that dynamic, for-profit colleges, villains, but can tend to be a distraction from a change in the business model that's happening across the spectrum of higher education, which I presume, I mean, without, and I don't want to go down this road, and maybe this is, you know, for a different day, but is basically the nonprofit, some higher education, some higher, you know, sort of like a high end institutions are basically using their name as a marketing tool, and but with a similar sort of side business that tends to be online in some circumstances that don't have the same accreditation requirements or get rolled under. Get credit for accreditation that may exist in a more substantial part of their educational institution, as it were. So,
yes, I think that's exactly right.
Okay, and And that's a dynamic, I think, that probably warrants a lot more investigation going forward. I mean, I've been reading a little bit about that. But lastly, so, you know, we've debunked the notion that it's regressive. But let's just end this on a maybe a less sort of like a more ideological, I guess, perspective on that. We need to return in many respects to the idea of higher education and education more broadly speaking to be a public good, right? It's not that this whole move to making it about a way of increasing your salary by X amount of dollars has proven not to be the case. And has also probably had very, very bad impact on the development of even nonprofit universities becoming scammy in some ways.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, this is kind of one of the areas where I have to lay at least some of the blame on my fellow economists, because I think it's really out of that milieu that the idea of education is something that you as a student invest in order to realize future returns in the form of higher earnings in the labor market. That whole construct kind of comes out of economic scholarship, and I think was really weaponized into policy in the late 60s and 70s, and as well as recently. So, you know, kind of continuously up through the more recent era as a means of undermining state support for higher education. And the idea was, well, you know, we can afford to transfer the cost of this to individuals and students because they're deriving the benefit from it, which is to say higher earnings. That turned out to be a bad theory of the labor market. We now know that. I'm a labor economist. This is basically what my primary research is about. And I think the implications of that are pretty profound for the higher education and, you know, more broadly, the education policy side of that coin. So, you know, we had an experiment of expanding public higher education and including at, you know, at different levels. So if you have something like the California Master Plan, the whole premise was that anyone who graduated from high school in the state of California and satisfied minimal educational requirements achievement requirements was able to find a place for them in higher education. This was supposed to be an engine of the state's future economic development coming from the creation of public institutions to accommodate a rising generation. I would argue, as I alluded to earlier, that a key weakness, so to speak, politically of that project was that the beneficiary population turned out to look a lot different than the people who were perceived to be financing it. And that made it prone to the anti-civil rights movement white backlash of the late 60s and early 70s that was crucial in undermining support both at the state level in many different states, as well as in the federal government, for whole higher education or public higher education systems that would be relatively accessible to a broad spectrum of the population. And, you know, I read literature coming from, you know, very, very right-wing economists of the 1960s basically saying, this is a social disaster. We're just letting anybody through the doors. What happened to standards? Let's use student debt in order to discipline the students so they don't feel like they have the run of the place, basically. And, you know, that's what we did. Like, we basically, the federal government implemented the policy recommendations of, you know, the right-wing crank economists of the 1960s in the backlash to the civil rights movement. So, yeah, I mean, if we're going forward from here, I think, first of all, we need to divorce higher education policy from this idea that the point of it is to improve outcomes in the labor market, because, you know, we tried that and it didn't work. But that doesn't mean that higher education policy has no point. On the contrary, I think it was a great achievement of civilization, if you want to put it in grandiose words, that we created institutions that had more in the way of universal access, that were designed to take this very nice thing that previously only the elite had access to and make it more broadly accessible. I think that's an inspiring ideology to kind of return to rather right. than this economistic idea of investing in your future earnings, especially if it's false.
All right. And I agree. And I think, you know, we should have the argument is the same reason why you would educate someone up to high school. I mean, make for better citizens at the end of the day.
Yeah. I mean, if I just add one more thing to that, you see here coming from some elites in Congress, for example, that, free college is like a racist policy, for example. And that is just ridiculous. It's not a racist policy for the same reason that Brown v. Board of Education is the opposite of a racist policy. It is making a public good broadly available regardless of race.
Right.
It's very important to take into account race when we design a free college policy, because we don't want to just have a segregated higher education system. But the idea that it's bad because it undermines an existing segregated system is ridiculous.
Okay. Lastly, let me just ask you this: the cost of education. The story that that I've heard two stories, and maybe they're not mutually exclusive, but one story is that the increase in availability for funds, fueled the rise in the availability of funds in the context of specifically in the nature of loans, fueled the rise in the increase in tuition. The other is that because states cut back on their support of the lowest cost option of college in any given state, that it created upward pressure on tuitions. Is either one of those stories inaccurate? What's the balance if it's both those things?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're both accurate, and I think that the overall narrative of credentialization of the labor market is what can reconcile those stories. And also, I mean, there may be other stories about the rise in costs of education. I think basically the motivating factors are two. One is increased demand for higher education, because in a weak labor market, people perceived higher education as the route to advancement when they did not realize the earnings that they thought they would get based on whatever education they previously would have had. So you have, people who previously would have just had a high school degree, not able to attain the middle class jobs that would have gone along with that educational attainment in prior decades, going to college. People who just have a 4-year degree or a 2-year degree getting more higher education than they would have. So there you have, what I've termed a rat race in other writings, where essentially the overall economic story is an increase in demand for higher education credentials. On the flip side, you have a decline in state support for public higher education institutions, such that you put institutions in the position of needing to find other ways to monetize their business, and credentialization is one of the key ways that they can. So, they want you to take on as much higher education as they can get you to, basically, and the federal government is there as the backstop, at least on the front end, issuing loans to more or less whoever wants them, whoever gets admitted. So the institutions are saying, okay, well, we've got, we're admitting larger class sizes, perhaps we're, increasing the classes, taught by any one professor. I mean, class sizes in higher ed, especially in community colleges, have increased, and the course offerings have decreased. So we're essentially, making this a less labor intensive type of business, while cramming as many more students through the door as possible in order to get them to pay as much tuition as possible. And that tuition will be financed by student debt, because we have to, given that the state is no longer the main pillar underlying our budget, it's got to be the students, basically.
Right.
So I think that dynamic, the increased demand and the reduced state funding, are together what give you the student debt crisis. There's pretty good research that shows, in some ways that it's the causality goes from the availability of federal student loans to higher tuition. So this is interesting, because it's there's this thing called the Bennett hypothesis, which is basically that the more state support, or sorry, the more student loan funding is available, the higher will tuition go, because the institutions will realize is that people have more ability to pay, at least on the front end, because they can basically right. finance everything with student debt. And the federal government's philosophy has been, we want more people to have more higher education. And the way to do that is to expand to increase loan limits under available under the federal student loan program. The Bennett hypothesis, as the name of it suggests, used to have a sort of right-wing flavor to it. It's named after the Secretary of Education under the George H.W. Bush administration. And that was kind of conceptualized as a anti-higher ed type of argument. And therefore, the left, if the left is in favor of higher ed, should say, Democratic establishment, if you want to call it that, is in favor of higher education institutions, this was considered an anti-higher education type right. of a message. I would say that is changing now, or at least I predict it will change in the future. That is to say, as student debtors and recent graduates are, much less enamored of their own alma maters, so to speak, as, than previous graduates would have been, because they feel like, when I went through this, the business model was make me pay as much as possible, take on as much debt as possible, and I didn't get the earnings increase right. that I thought I was going to. As the public, especially student debtors, kind of shifts against, no longer seeing higher education as like the defining moment of their lives and identifying enormously with the brand of the institution that they went to, that will change the ideological valence of the hypothesis such that it becomes more of a lefty type idea.
Huh. But so aside from just sort of people changing their perspective on it, I guess it's not something that we can know with any type of real clarity. There's all these factors and we don't have a sense of what's driving it. I mean,
yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of interlinked phenomena that get rise to the pressure on tuitions to increase and the increasing student debt burdens on, both in the sense that, people with a BA have higher debt burdens coming out of their BA than people with a BA would have had years ago,
right.
as well as many more people going through the system and therefore a larger share of the population having any experience of student debt. So this is that latter thing is really where I take exception to the idea that student debt cancellation is regressive, as we were discussing before.
And ultimately, it just turns out that a big factor, as you're saying, is that the worth of a college education in the context of actual real dollars has been inflated without it's been overvalued, I guess, is really what it comes down.
And I have in my writings,
drove up the price.
Yeah, and including in the current affairs thing. So, I have said, we have this diminishing value of higher education degree in the context of the labor market, which is inducing people to get more higher education degrees in order to kind of get themselves up to the level that they thought, lower educational attainment would entitle them. That has some of the qualities of a bubble, but it's not going to burst like the housing bubble did. So people ask me, is the student debt the next bubble after the housing bubble or something? In economic terms, no, because student debt is unsecured. The dynamics of a housing bubble are, you took on a bigger mortgage than your house is now worth, so you have to sell your house to pay back your mortgage. And the sale of that house causes the price of houses to go down further. And there's this what we call debt deflation
right.
dynamic. So the price of housing just sort of collapses in, the space of a few months or a year. That's what happened in 2007, I guess, through 2008. In student debt, we're not going to get that sudden decline in what a college degree is worth. Instead, it's a slow deflation of the bubble over a long period of time. And that is exactly what we're observing with credentialization in labor market outcomes. So that student debt bubble is going to deflate, if you want to call it that, over a period of decades. And, who knows whether that's more damaging to the economy or less damaging than a sudden macroeconomic right. collapse. If everybody is sort of laboring under the burden of the student debt that their earnings aren't enough to pay off over a period of decades, that can have severe negative consequences for long-run growth and the economy overall. I think we're starting to see the evidence of that in, for example, the public service loan forgiveness. When that program was created a little over 10 years ago, there was no thought that it would be as large as it has turned out to be. So the way that they've kind of retroactively shrunk it down to the size that it was supposed to be is to just not forgive the people's debt that they said they were going to. And consequently, all these people who have constructed their careers out of eventually being eligible for PSLF, suddenly on the other end of it, they're like, wait a second.
Right. We're getting screwed. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So, well, we got to save that for another day. But Marshall, I appreciate your time today. Folks can read more. We will link to your current affairs piece from earlier this month, September 5th. And we will talk about it. We will link to it there and people can read more. But Marshall, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yep, it's been great. Thanks for talking.
Welcome back, folks. Great stuff with Marshall Steinbaum. I just want to let you all know that this episode was brought to you by Blinkist. This episode was brought to you by Blinkist. The Blinkist app takes the key takeaways from thousands of best-selling nonfiction books and condenses them into just 15 minutes for you to read or listen to. 10 million people are using Blinkist right now. It has a massive and growing library from self-help and business to health and industry books. Right now, you can get 25% off of your first year at Blinkist.com/majority. Blinkist.com/majority link on the homepage. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Tonight on the Michael Brooks Show, Anna Kasparian joins us to talk about the clarity we need on single-payer healthcare, why Elizabeth Warren isn't providing it, what we need for housing policy. She's going to make the case for impeachment. I'm talking about doing an overview of the various political factions inside Palestine and Israel. And as you know, we're doing a brief intro to world systems theory and Emmanuel Wallerstein, and also going over Elizabeth Warren's Council on Foreign Relations questionnaire and looking at Pete Buttigieg at total ease with people on strike. Patreon.com/TMBS. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Snag your tickets for the TMBS live show November 23rd. That's the week before Thanksgiving. Several people still have asked me about that. There's no schedule conflict. It's okay. It's at World Cafe with Crystal Ball, Emma Viglin, and Artesia Balthrop. Those are some significant heavy hitters right there. That's going to be a very fun show. And I have to say, man, these ones, they've all been really good. I'm happy with everything we've done. But when we were in Chicago, it was definitely this is just getting...
It's heating up.
We're ironing it out. We're getting close to our 10,000 hours. Do we have a link to... Let's just throw that up on screen and maybe put it... I think it's on the homepage. Just so you can get your tickets to the Philly show. See you tonight at 7 o'clock. You got it? You can't find... All right, we'll do it later. Jamie, what's cooking?
This week on the Antifada, we speak with Nadia Guyot, an organizer from No New Jails, about the current ongoing campaign to close Rikers and not replace it with anything. Instead, decarcerate people and reinvest money in communities so people don't end up in jail to begin with, which is a much better plan, in my opinion. We also talk about prison abolition more generally and as part of our overarching political horizon. I want to remind everyone, we have a live show of our own coming up at Littlefield NYC on Saturday, October 12th. It's going to be pretty great, I think. We're doing it with Pod Damn America, our goth socialist sister show led by the comedian Jake Flores. We got me. We got Sean. We got AP Andy. We got Jake Flores, Alex Patak, Anders Lee. That's just the core group of podcasters. And then we have some really awesome guests. They are Leslie Lee III from Struggle Session King, Matt Chrisman in Virgil, Texas from Chapo Trap House.
Heavy hitters.
Need no introduction. Simone Norman, very funny comedian, and a live drag performance from Comrade Barbie.
I don't know the last two people, but I totally trust you. Comrade Barbie's Brendan, though, right?
You gotta come to the show.
You gotta go to find
and
out.
See if Comrade Barbie looks at all familiar to you.
Mm, fascinating. Get your tickets.
Literary, I put a link there.
Oh, yep. Most recently on Literary Hangover, I did a solo episode on Habermock by a woman named Lydia Maria Child. It came out in 1824. She's sort of a very early feminist and abolitionist. In fact, she wrote the first anti-slavery work in book form in America. She also, when she was 20, the book I talk about, Habermock, It includes a white woman going off and marrying and having a child with a Native American. So it was rather scandalous for the 1820s. Exactly. That's the tone of it.
So. OG Elizabeth Warren.
Wait, no. That was... The answer to Wolves beats Borat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's very ahead of her time.
She's very ahead of her time. No, I've actually... I began the episode. It's fascinating. All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.